News 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati, VXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Mark Haney, who's out today. Later in the show, we'll hear from authors of Walking Cincinnati. Their book provides maps for 32 walking tours throughout greater Cincinnati neighborhoods. But first, what would it mean to cities if they were designed so people would walk more to the store, the bank, the doctor? City planner and urban designer Jeff Speck has written a book called Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America, One Step at a Time. He joins us on the phone today to discuss the benefits of making cities more pedestrian-friendly. He'll be in town later this month to speak at the Cincinnati Preservation Association's annual Fall Forum. And with us in the studio, Cincinnati Preservation Association President Paul Muller and communications consultant Deborah DelValle. We'd like to hear from you, too. You can join the conversation by calling us at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon, Marianne.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Jeff, we're going to start with you. And where did you get the idea for this book? It's a few years old now. Where did it all come from?
Oh, boy. I'm a city planner and I'm also a writer, and I'm a city planner every day and a writer on occasion. And writing isn't all that much fun for me. When people ask me if I like writing, I say I like having written, but not the actual act of writing itself. But every now and then you learn as you work in different communities that there's a message that you share in those communities that seems to be very powerful, that seems to make a lot of change, that seems to allow good things to happen. And then you move on to the next community and you start, you know, on square one all over again, and it's an extremely frustrating experience. So this is actually the second time I've written a book out of the sheer desire to shortcut that experience of moving from city to city and starting over again with a conversation that actually is advancing all across the country but isn't hitting everywhere with equal speed or power.
Well, let's talk about the idea itself. You suggest that if people spend more time, if cities are designed in a way that more people walk to get where they need to go, it'll be very beneficial for the area. And, of course, we hear of it as obviously beneficial for people's health if they walk more. It's beneficial for the environment if people aren't driving cars as much. But you say it's beneficial for the economy. Can you explain that to us?
Absolutely. So, it's interesting as a planner, arguing for certain things, mostly that all fit under the framework of walkability, from the perspective of a planner for many years and making some headway, but maybe not so much, and then observing over the last 15, 20 years how different fields, and you mentioned health and the environment, but also economists began to argue quite intelligently for walkability from their own perspective, and seeing how people kind of turn on a dime when they listen to those experts as opposed to listening to us. People certainly care, not everyone, but people certainly care that walkable cities are much more sustainable than driving cities in terms of preserving the environment. They care when doctors tell you that you'll live a lot longer if you live in a downtown versus living in a suburban area, which I could elaborate on. It's pretty interesting. But the economical discussion is really, in most cities, particularly because I work in a lot of Republican cities, I'll admit, it's the most powerful one because people really want to be competitive. And there's a bunch of different ways that being walkable makes you more competitive. But probably the biggest one is just that nowadays the workforce is mobile. People who are educated and intelligent and successful or on their way to success have the choice about where they want to live. And they are choosing to live in places that satisfy certain criteria, and they're moving there, and then they're being productive. It's not the old days of moving to where the factory is or moving to where the job is. 67% of millennials, these engines of entrepreneurship in our communities, decide first where they want to live, then do they move there, and only then do they look for a job. And the criteria which determines where they want to live are many, but really up near the top is not being dependent on driving everywhere you need to go and not wanting to live in a suburban, kind of dull, repetitive environment.
If I can jump in, this is Paul. Jeff, we sort of have a living laboratory for that here in Cincinnati and over the Rhine. It's really attracted a lot of those young, talented people who could really live anywhere they wanted to. And a number of startup companies and incubators for sort of the next economy have taken root in over the Rhine. It's gotten a lot of national attention because of its the power of it.
And I would note too that for people of my generation, the baby boom generation, I know baby boomers who now are moving back into the city and moving back into over the Rhine. I know friends who lived out in the suburbs. Now they live across from Washington Park. They love it because they want to make that choice about the neighborhood too and being able to walk to the things that they want to walk to.
Now, Jeff,
for baby boomers, you know, they're technically speaking, statistically a larger group than the millennials. They're basically the millennials' parents. What you find in many communities is that they're willing to move to the urban environment once their children's generation has "quote unquote" made it safe. Right? They don't want to move in. They don't want to move in until it's a little bit, until someone else has been the pioneer. But actually, there's a very strong urge among some boomers, and I wouldn't say necessarily even the majority, but those who are thinking about their future well-being and realize that they're becoming worse drivers and that maybe they shouldn't be driving for so many more years, understand that you can walk around a lot longer than you should drive around, and a compact, mixed-use, pedestrian-friendly environment is ideal for aging in place and aging in a healthy way where you're actually having daily activity that keeps you alive longer.
Now, Jeff, you're going to be in town here later this month for this event, the Fall Forum for the Cincinnati Preservation Association. Tell us, have you ever been to Cincinnati before?
I have not, and that is really strange because I've been to 49 states. I've been to almost every major metro area. I've been to your airport, which I understand is in Kentucky.
True.
Many times, even probably last month. I've been to Akron. I've been to Columbus as recently as last week. I was in Columbus. I've been to Cleveland several times, and I'm going to Cleveland later next week. And by the way, the event is next week. It's not too far ahead of now. But for one reason or another, I've never been to, or actually no good reason, I've never been to Cincinnati. Yeah. I don't know much about it.
You're saving the best to last.
There you go. But I intend to become an expert by next week, because the talks I give, I always try to cater to the city, and I have been studying your downtown thanks to the miracle of Google Maps and Google Earth, and I feel like I'll have something to contribute. Although I have to say, there is no substitute for actually spending time in a place. I always try to learn as much as I can about a community virtually before I get there in person.
You know, cities initially before cars were walkable cities. When did all of this start to change?
Oh boy, well, everything changed in the long gap of the Depression plus the Second World War. So there was this period, from the end of the 20s, really, through the middle of the 40s, where not only was almost no building done, but the people who were designing and building our communities, beautifully, I would add, and it's very hard to find a community that isn't gorgeous, that was built, before 1930, all those people died or retired or just stopped working. And part and parcel with that kind of changing of the guard was a changing in the ethos where, America, not just our leaders and not just our car manufacturers in a conspiracy, but really everyone, the whole culture, embraced automobility. And, when they actually, staged the photo op and set fire to the streetcars that they were removing and replacing with buses, people showed up and celebrated. There was this real feeling of freedom around the replacement of transit of rails with roads. That said, there were many, many powerful government subsidies at play, including racism driving people out of the cities. It was kind of this perfect storm of highway funding and federal home loan programs that made it cheaper to build a new house for yourself in the suburbs than to stay in your apartment in the city, and redlining that people are surprised to learn was done not so much by banks but by the federal government. It was the federal government determining which neighborhoods it would insure loans in that was doing the principal redlining. And if your neighborhood had a mixed race, it was not worthy of a loan. So there was all these government subsidies at play in conjunction with, of course, white flight and the celebration of the automobile that just fully decanted our cities of much of their people and wealth.
Do you find that some of those cities, though, that that were older city, that are older cities, you have a better chance of making them walkable again than newer cities who never had that basic structure in them to make them walkable areas?
Yes, absolutely. I'm not just talking about, Cincinnati. I'm talking about any suburb or smaller city that surrounds Cincinnati that may have grown up before, or that did grow up principally before World War II. Any place that has a main street, or ideally a network of streets in a real downtown, has the potential to become, again, a lively, walkable place, and many of them are. The places that it's very hard to fix, and I work in them sometimes, but with great fear that I won't be able to help, are these post-war suburban places where you lack traditional main streets, and you actually lack, and now we'll get into planner, esoterica, you lack a porous street network. If you don't have a lot of streets intersecting, making a lot of blocks, you probably don't have a walkable area. And you may be aware that post-war planning was principally, they threw out the network, or the grid, and they replaced it with this system, this branching system, where the highway connects to the arterial, which connects to the collector, and then to the local street and the parking lot, where there's no street network. And those neighborhoods just do not support pedestrian life, and it's almost impossible to fix them.
Do you find that that's true in the Cincinnati area, Paul? Are there some areas that are much easier to become walkable areas than others?
Yeah, it's exactly what Jeff is saying. We were constructed around a principle of walkability and rail transit, and we have the basin, which everyone is familiar with, and then the hills came in and made this wonderful distinction, which really drove a lot of density. The reason Over the Rhine looks more like Brooklyn than someplace in Columbus or Indianapolis is because when the expansion hit the hills, they had to go vertically with their buildings. So we have 4, 5, 6-story buildings in an Italianate neighborhood. But our local neighborhood business districts that ring that are exactly this Main Street type of structure that Jeff's talking about. Clifton's Business District, Hyde Park, O'Brienville, Walnut Hills, Price Hill. They all have these little clusters where their apartments surrounding retail spaces that then step off to houses of different sizes. And those
By the way, I've yet to meet a neighborhood called Hyde Park that isn't excellent.
We're talking about making cities more walkable. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik, filling in for Mark Haney. We're talking today about making cities more walkable. Joining me, city planner and urban designer Jeff Speck. He's written a book called Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time. He joins us on the phone. Also, he'll be in town later this month to speak at the Cincinnati Preservation Association's annual Fall Forum. And with us in the studio, Cincinnati Preservation Association President Paul Muller and communications consultant Deborah DeVal. Again, if you have a question, 513-419-7100. And we're going to go now to Brian in East Walnut Hills. Hi, Brian. What's your question?
Yeah, it's funny that you have the caller on. I've been going over all these things with my wife lately, and I think the thing that he said right before the break almost epitomizes everything I've come to understand about the city and development after the war. A little history. I grew up in the suburbs, Anderson Township, lived for 20 years in northern Kentucky, only 3 years ago moved back into the city. So I've become very interested in these topics. But one thing I find unique about Cincinnati is, unlike a Columbus or an Indianapolis, where they were able to annex a lot of territory, in Cincinnati, we were landlocked by other municipalities, and the city itself could not expand for years. And how much of a role did that play in Cincinnati's decline from its height of population in the 50s to where it is now versus a Columbus or an Indianapolis, whose trajectories are all going up, whereas we have barely stayed the course in terms of population in the last couple decades?
Jeff?
Well, it's interesting that, cities in the U.S., and it tends to be more geographic, where mostly eastern cities, and I'm from the East Coast, but mostly eastern cities did not do that much annexing, and mostly western cities did a lot of annexing. I work in Oklahoma City, which I think is the biggest city in America, but it's just because it happens to contain all of its suburbs. But if you compare the fates economically of those two types of cities, there is a strong tendency for those that annexed to have done a lot better, simply because as the city expanded and, frankly, as I suggested, the wealth decanted, the wealth moved to places that were still in the city, and you ended up with a tax base that was more an accurate cross-section of all the people living in the area, as opposed to, when the wealthy people move out, they actually are no longer supporting you economically. The economist Myron Orfeld has shown very clearly how in many American cities, and he looks at Minneapolis, St. Paul, but how in many American cities, actually, because of the cost of building suburban infrastructure and the way that the states cause revenues to be distributed, that most inner cities are subsidizing actively the construction of sprawl at their own expense. So those cities that contain both unfortunately, those cities that contain both downtown areas and traditionally organized areas and sprawl tended to do a little bit better. Now, the good news is, as many of you are aware, and as Over the Rhine is showing you, people are moving back to cities and wealth is moving back to cities. And as people begin to vote with their feet about the sort of environment they want to be in, we're going to see cities doing better and better. But it'll be a long time before we can make up for that great imbalance that happened in the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Yeah, huh? And just to add two things specific to Cincinnati about that, our decline in population started in the mid-50s, and a lot of the drop from 550,000 to 350,000 was attributed to the construction of the interstates. So, again, mm-hmm. it's sort of ironic that putting those in also removed enormous number of very small houses. I mean, it took out more houses than a normal interstate project would have done. And the other thing is we're seeing the census tracts that are increasing in population correspond very closely to the ones where the historic districts are. People are moving to the areas with the older architecture, which sort of brings up the intersection of walkability and preservation. Because I know, Jeff, when Margaret Valentine, our chair, called you to invite you to be our speaker this year, I think she reported your first words were, "But I'm not a preservationist." And we said, great.
It certainly wasn't, but I'm not a preservationist because I enjoy speaking to preservation groups and I do it a lot. But I should say that the preservation discussion is a really important one. In my book, I talk about the four steps of walkability and what you need to accomplish to be walkable, in that the walk needs to be useful, safe, comfortable, and interesting. And in that interesting category, one of the most important things is just having character and a place that's different from everywhere else in America. And these days in America, the places that are different almost entirely are those places that were built before this great scourge of, mass production suburbanization, where, frankly, if you drive around, the East or the Southeast, the places that I know the best, every great little city, even, a tourist haven like Fredericksburg or Charleston, is surrounded by a ring of the exact same junk that's everywhere in America, and there's absolutely no reason to visit. The other thing about historic buildings, of course, is that they're older. The mortgages are already paid off. They're not the same cost on a monthly basis of building something new, and that allows people to take risks. Jane Jacobs, in the best planning book ever, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, she said, new ideas need old buildings. Because, until the mortgage is paid down and you're not struggling to fund the construction, you don't have the freedom to not be a lawyer, right? You got to be the lawyer, and then someone else can come in who's the graphic designer.
Brian, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. Again, our phone number is 513-419-7100. If you have a question or a comment, we go now to Corey. Corey, you're not from Cincinnati. Where are you from? Corey?
Oh, hello there. Yeah. I had a question. I was going to say, I love walking around old towns and all that, but I was also wondering, is there any way to make those towns more pedestrian friendly while being able to compromise with making them more friendly for the traffic of large trucks? to be able to deliver goods to those businesses to help them thrive more, because towns, especially like Cincinnati, are very tough for large trucks to get through as it is with the way it's all
designed. Are you a truck driver?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to answer that, Jeff? What do you think?
Well, I think the caller is insightful in understanding that those two intentions do work at cross purposes to each other. It certainly is true, though, that most of the most walkable places in the country still receive large trucks in good number. There are some, and this pertains particularly to fire trucks, which can be the biggest constraint when you're trying to design a place and make it walkable. There are some communities that make the choice to limit the size of the trucks and say, some cities have realized that they've been speccing fire trucks that are too big for the old streets that they have. But in terms of deliveries, some cities do limit it to smaller trucks. But the main thing I've found, and this is getting a little bit technical, but the main thing I've found with handling deliveries in very walkable areas is it's less an issue of design and more an issue of management, managing hours, managing loading zones, making sure that, frankly, the likelihood of trucks coming is part of the design equation from the very beginning, because it is sometimes forgotten. But we can't put the cart in front of the horse, however, and forget that what drives people to shop in the stores in these places that receive these goods by truck is that they're places where people want to be, and we don't want to sacrifice that.
So you got to work it all out. Corey, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. Again, our number, 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition, and we're talking about making cities more walkable. Thanks to Sherry Petroff for listening to 91.7 WVXU today. We go now to Carol from Chillicothe. Hi, Carol. What's your question?
Hi. Well, I was wondering if anyone looked at or has a comment on Fort Thomas right across the river from Cincinnati.
I lived there
for a good number of years. Okay. So you know what I'm talking about as far as walkability goes. There are little pockets where there are everything, professional offices, a pharmacy, a dry cleaner, everything you could want, you can walk to pretty much, except you can need to go to a large department store. But the one comment that I also had was when I was living there, a Japanese friend was visiting me. She lived in New Hampshire. And she commented on the fact that everybody in Fort Thomas seemed to walk, and asked me if that was true of most of the Midwest, because she'd never seen that in the East. So I was just wondering if were any comments. I believe Fort Thomas did grow up after the war, and they don't have a lot of cross streets, as you know. So,
well, it's built on a ridge. I know that it certainly was a Civil War city, so it's been around for a long time. Paul, do you have any details you want to add to that?
Well, it's one of these little nodes that had their own walkability. I don't know what its walk score is, but I do think people seek out, those realtors will tell you that people are seeking out areas that have a higher degree of walkability, and Jeff probably can talk about that in more detail.
Jeff, I guess you've not ever been to Fort Thomas, since you haven't been to Cincinnati, but maybe you should check it out when you're here.
I haven't. I spent a lot of time in New Hampshire, though, and people don't like to walk all that much.
It's a lot colder in New Hampshire, too. So,
but there are towns in New Hampshire like Portsmouth and Exeter that are lovely for walking. And I think to the caller's question, I don't think it's a cultural thing. I don't think it's a regional thing. I do think it's principally an outcome of the environment. I should say the built environment. And so, obviously, Port Thomas is a place that was designed properly for this, and hopefully I'll get a tour of it while I'm there.
Carol, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. We have time for one more quick call, and this is Mark in Mount Lookout. Hi, Mark. Quickly, what's your question?
Hi. Thanks for having me. So, basically, I was wondering, when we make our cities more walkable or add pedestrian-friendly or transit-friendly infrastructure, there's a lot of pushback from drivers who believe that, since we're pushing for a more walkable city, we want fewer cars and we don't want them to drive, and they don't like that so much. So I was wondering, how can we, in the future, more coexist with drivers and walkers?
Jeff, can you get to that quickly?
Yeah, there's no short answer to that. You start by saying quickly, that the it is true, generally speaking, in the broadest sense, that making a city better for walking often means making it a little bit less convenient for drivers. But I should say that most of the places I work, there are win-win situations. Streets, for example, that have one more lane than the amount of traffic on that street would suggest that it needs, where you can turn that lane into a protected cycle track or into the parallel parking that was taken away, damaging the businesses that needed it, or some other purpose. I always look for the opportunities where actually we can increase walkability without removing drivability. But that said, drivers tend to adjust, and as you widen streets, more of them come, and as you narrow streets, less of them come, and it doesn't seem to impact the economics of the region at all.
Mark, thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it. Just one more very quick question for you, Jeff. You'll be talking about all of this, of course, when you're in town next week, but any other idea briefly about the cost of it all?
Oh, there is no cheaper way to provide mobility than walking, and mobility equals wealth. You know, in our communities, that's why cities exist. You know, they existed at hubs of trading and transportation. Mobility generates wealth, and if we can provide mobility in the least expensive way, we will have the most wealthy city at the lowest cost.
But does it cost does it cost a lot of money to make those cities walkable?
Absolutely not. And to the point I was making earlier in terms of reallocating street space, we often do it just with paint. You know, turning a driving lane into a bike lane or something else like of that nature is about the cheapest change you can make in the city.
All right. And this fall forum, Deb, it comes up. What's the date on that?
It's October 23rd.
October 23rd. So that is next week. Well, thanks all of you for being here today. What a pleasure.
Thank you.
We've been talking. Thanks, Jeff. We've been talking about making cities more walkable. Our guests were city planner and urban designer Jeff Speck. He's written a book called Walkable City, How Downtown Can Save America One Step at a Time, along with Cincinnati Preservation Association President Paul Muller and communications consultant Deborah DelValle. Jeff Speck will be in town, as we said, later this month to speak at the Cincinnati Preservation Association's annual fall forum. Our show continues in just a moment. You're going to hear from Mark Haney. He's not here today, but this is an interview he did earlier. He's going to talk with the authors of Walkable Cincinnati. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.